You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Clearly, the theme that was begun in the Synoptic Gospels, that of the disciples being a bunch of lunkheads, is picked up on by John and is very clear in our passage today. The scene is John's version of the Last Supper. Jesus is washing the disciples' feet, warning them that he's going to be betrayed, and then reassuring them with words of encouragement, some of which most of you would recognize, like, "In my Father's house there are many rooms, and I go to prepare a place for you," and those kind of things. Thomas is all whiny and asks, "Yeah, but Jesus, how will we know the way?" And we get the Jesus classic, "Well, Thomas, I am the way," which, of course, totally confuses the disciples further. And unconvinced, Philip says, "Okay, Jesus, if you're all that, then show us the Father and we'll believe you." You can almost hear Jesus saying through clenched teeth, "Ah! Can't a person get quality help around here anymore? Sheesh." So Jesus says, "Look, do you see me?" Yeah, they say. "Do you see what I've been doing?" Yeah, they say. "Well, then what's the problem? If you've seen me, then you see who sent me." And while Jesus himself may be doubting the truth of it at the moment, he goes on to say, "And you're going to be doing greater things than I've done." He said, "What?" Well, let's hear our passage for today, and then we'll unpack it.
Our words of wisdom are from John, chapter 14, verse 12.
Jesus said, "Very truly, I tell you, the one who believes in me will also do the works that I do. In fact, will do greater works than these, because I am going to the Father."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Greater works than these? Greater works than Jesus? Jesus, you've got to be kidding. Is Jesus expecting me to do something more spectacular than healing people? Than walking on water? I can't even get my everyday life together. And God expects me to do what? Well, first, let's take a look at a few things and be clear about what Jesus never did. First, when you take away the childhood escape to Egypt that Matthew came up with, Jesus never ventured outside of a small corridor in ancient Palestine, the greatest distance being about the equivalent of Fountain Hills to Payson. And then when it comes to confronting the social and ethical injustices in his world, Jesus evidently didn't get started until he was around 30. And then that was at most for only a year. Then for the most part, Jesus shared a lot of common values with his opponents. They were all religious people. They just disagreed on how to live out their convictions. Then let's be clear about what Jesus' works were. What did he do? Well, he practiced healing. He challenged religious legalism, he associated with outcasts, and he performed what were interpreted to be miracles, all the while demonstrating an intimate relationship with a power greater than himself. And if we break down each of these works, I think it's clear that they don't all assume supernatural wonder-working. First off, Jesus associated with outcasts. Can we include the excluded? Speak up for the voiceless? Check. Jesus challenged religious legalism. Can we set aside harmful dogma and demonstrate grace? Well, check. Jesus practiced healing. And aside from the examples of supernatural healing, most of Jesus' healing acts simply acknowledged people as being forgiven. So can we practice radical forgiveness and acceptance? Well, check. Well, what about those miracles? As for me, I see most of Jesus' miracles being in the category of metaphor or literary devices of the gospel writers. But can we today do the miraculous and slow down enough to be in awe of the wonder of nature, the miracle of life, and the relationships that we normally take for granted? Well, check. Basically, Jesus deconstructed the idea that being religious was about obeying strict rules and believing all the right stuff. In all of his works, he demonstrated a relational approach, both to the divine and his fellow human beings. It was dynamic and fluid and always prioritized loving acceptance. So can we get over our fixation on rules and prioritize authentic, intimate relationships, even with our opponents, even with strangers? A few years ago, a taxi driver picked up a rabbi in New York City to head out to Long Island and JFK. After a few minutes of conversation, they discovered that, years before, the taxi driver had actually belonged to the very synagogue that the rabbi now served. While they sat in heavy traffic, the driver asked, "So, Rabbi, what do you say to a Jew like me who hasn't been in a synagogue since his bar mitzvah?" Now, the rabbi thought for a minute and recalled that in Hasidic lore, the Baal Akala, the wagon driver, is an honored profession. So the rabbi said, "We could talk about your work." The driver scoffed. "What does my work have to do with religion?" "Well," said the rabbi, "you're a taxi driver, but you're also a piece of the tissue that connects all of humanity. You're taking me to the airport. I'll go to a different city and give a couple of lectures that might touch or help or change someone. I couldn't have gotten there without you. You help make that connection happen. Then, and I heard on your radio that after you drop me off, you're going to pick up a woman from the hospital and take her home. That means that you'll probably be the first non-medical person that she encounters after being in the hospital. You will play a small role in her healing process, an agent in her re-entry into the world of health. Then the person you pick up from the train station might be coming from seeing a dying parent. You might take someone to the house of the one that he or she will ask to join them in marriage. You're a connector, a bridge builder. You're one of the countless unseen people who make the world work as well as it does. That is holy work. You may not think of it this way, but yours is a sacred mission. Can we look at our everyday actions as holy work? Can we contribute to the wholeness of another person? Can we forgive others? I think yes. But that's still just doing what Jesus did. He said we would do greater works than these. And not just metaphorically or symbolically, but actual works. I was in seminary in the mid-1980s, and if you remember, it was a heady time of scientific discovery when the first test tube babies were being born, and there was preliminary talk of mapping out and eventually being able to adjust the human genome. So, what better time to be dating a genetic engineer? One night we were out to dinner with some folks who were pretty conservative religiously. When they discovered that my date was a genetic engineer, they made no bones about declaring genetic engineering unethical and such pursuits being dangerously close to playing God. Well, my date's response was remarkably measured and downright rabbinical. She asked, "Well, how many people do you think Jesus healed? Maybe a few here and there?" Then she quoted today's passage. "Didn't Jesus say we would do greater works than these?" Well, genetic engineers are working towards eradicating whole diseases from the face of the earth. Don't you think that's in the spirit of what Jesus meant? Well, that was the end of the discussion and of dinner. And she was right. But we can't all be genetic engineers making inroads into curing diseases around the world. So how are we going to take this claim of doing greater works than these with any seriousness? Let's look again at the Jesus things. Contributing to someone's wholeness, holding those in power accountable, forgiving one another, being brutally honest, showing compassion towards and acceptance of all people. These are all demonstrations of a dynamic faith that is lived out in the context of relationships, both individual and corporate. But you'd be right to observe that right now, relationships are strained at every level of society. Families, education, corporate, religious, and of course, political. The last few years have been especially gut-wrenching and heartbreaking. Families being torn apart by differing opinions about the pandemic. Churches being broken up over the treatment of LGBTQ folks. Fears and hatred being stoked by politicians. Books being banned. Refugee children being ripped from the arms of their parents at our border. Transgender folks being demonized, the rolling back of women's reproductive rights. But despite the strain, I think that in the final analysis, all of this chaos and disorientation can actually have a positive effect. How? It stirs us up. It stirs us in all sorts of ways to clarify our values, to raise our voices, and as Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say, to pray with our feet, because silence and inaction makes us nothing less than complicit. And one of those ways we've been most complicit that we need to be honest about with ourselves and within our institutions is that concentrated, virulent fear-mongering of the other is a dark and toxic part of the American narrative. See if this sounds familiar. There was panic when the migrants multiplied on the highways. Men of property were terrified for their property. Men who had never been hungry saw the eyes of the hungry. Men who had never wanted anything very much saw the flare of want in the eyes of the migrants. And the men of the towns and of the soft suburban country gathered to defend themselves. And they reassured themselves that they were good and the invaders bad, as a man must do before he fights. They said, "They're dirty and ignorant. They're degenerate sexual maniacs. They're thieves. They'll steal anything. They've got no sense of property rights. We can't have them in the schools. They're strangers. How'd you like to have your sister go out with one of them?" Sound familiar? It's actually John Steinbeck from his 1939 book, The Grapes of Wrath. And who are the dirty, ignorant, degenerates that he's describing? Desperate Okies trying to make their way from the dust bowl of Oklahoma to California and a better life. We just play the same damn tape over and over again, don't we? Got any Irish here? Get out, you degenerate sexual maniac! Got any Germans here? Get out, you damn dirty kraut! Got any recovering Catholics? Get out before you pollute our pure and cultured waspiness. Look, the first disciples weren't called the people who've got it all figured out, but the people of the way. They were said to be on a journey. And Jesus had had confidence, even in his dim-witted disciples, that they were capable of doing greater works than Jesus. So what are we going to do? Hey, I've got a phone. Well, use it. Hey, I've got a car. Well, then drive it. Hey, I've got a computer. Then write horrible social media rants. Oh, no, wait, don't forget. Erase that last bit. Don't do that. Seriously, when Jesus said we would do greater works than these, I don't believe he meant we would do more flashy miracles. I think he meant we would do more compassion, more truth to power, more reconciliation, more understanding in the midst of an increasingly complex, suspicious, and chaotic world, a world that Jesus could not have ever even imagined. We have got to get it out of people's heads that the pinnacle of Christian behavior is obeying rules and believing the right stuff. When we are connected to the heart of what Jesus was on about, we are connected to the kind of core values that define the best of humanity: compassion, empathy, and defending the basic dignity of others. Yeah, looking around at the reality of the world around us, you may feel depleted and just want to throw up your arms in despair. But too bad for you, because as a follower of Jesus, you're not allowed to bury your head in the sand, but to look beyond expressions of fearful, exclusive, punitive, and cruel policies and actions to see that they will not have the final word. We are called to be healers, liberators, lovers, and doers of Jesus things. And the world is so screwed up, it's a perfect time to rise to the challenge of doing greater things than we ever dared imagine, about which there's some good news and some bad news. The good news is, it's up to us now. The bad news, it's up to us now. Giacomo Puccini wrote some of the most familiar operas in our culture, including La Bohème and Madame Butterfly. In 1922, he began writing Turandot, which many now consider his best, unaware that he would soon begin a battle with terminal cancer. He worked on the score day and night, despite his friend's advice to rest to save his energy. Eventually, he died in 1924, leaving the work unfinished. His disciples gathered all that was written of Turandot, studied it in great detail, and then, knowing their teacher well, proceeded to write the last two scenes of the opera in his style and spirit. The world premiere was performed in the La Scala Opera House in Milan in 1926. It was conducted by Arturo Toscanini, Puccini's favorite student. The opera went beautifully until Toscanini came to the end of the part written personally by Puccini. He stopped the music, put down his baton, turned around to the audience, and said, "Here the maestro laid down his pen." There was a long pause. No one moved. Then, according to legend, Toscanini picked up the baton, turned to the audience, and with tears streaming down his face, announced, "But his disciples finished his work," and turned back to the orchestra to conduct the rousing finale. The opera closed to thunderous applause and to a permanent place in the annals of great musical works. Toscanini finished his master's greatest work. Will we? Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.